Thank you. I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. The time is 1:33, and today is Tuesday, March 19th. Legislators present are Representative Story, Representative Drummond, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Clayman, Representative Stutes, and myself, Chair Wolf. We have 6 members present. We have a quorum to conduct business. I'd like to thank Eric Heimbinger, the moderator, and Julian Bushman, recording secretary. Today, the committee will hear presentations on the economic value and impact of Alaska's ports. The ports of Whittier, Seward, and Anchorage are invited testimony, and also the port of Bellingham, Washington. First up, we have Jim Hunt, city manager of Whittier, to talk about the port of Whittier. Mr. Hunt is joining us online. Yep, okay. They say he's online. He's on my. Oh, I got to hit a button or something. Okay. Anyhow, Mr. Whittier, if you're on the line, could you identify yourself and proceed with your presentation?
Yes, thank you. Greetings. This is Jim Hunt. I am the city manager of Whittier, Alaska. I'd like to say hello to the co-chair Stu, co-chair Wool, and the transportation committee members. First, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to testify regarding this critical issue regarding ports in Alaska. The city of Whittier would like to express its support for the Alaska Marine Highway Service in Whittier and Alaska, while also recognizing the financial challenges that we as a state face in funding this service. We would also like to encourage the idea of possibly home porting the Northern Prince William Sound Ferry in Whittier, as it would likely provide less expensive housing options for its crews and provide, you know, easy access to the Seward Highway, which is just minutes away. A little bit about my background. I most recently served as the city manager for Seward for nearly 7 years, and I'm also an accredited Marine Port Executive. During this time, I had the great fortune to work with, you know, great and fantastic councils, excellent staff, and as many people are aware, we fully developed the Seward Marine Industrial Center, the new breakwater, the uplands, in addition to replacing the aging docks that were in the harbor near downtown. The work in the industrial center has resulted in economic growth via new business development, expanded existing businesses, and has generated millions of dollars in business revenue, which benefits not only Seward, but also Alaska. My new challenge now is, as the new city manager in Whittier, is to assist in developing Whittier to its full potential and aid Alaska, but not only serving as a new port site, but hopefully to be identified as an official backup in the event of an emergency in Anchorage. As many know, we're located on the northernmost ice-free deep water bay in south central Alaska, and uniquely, the city owns the tidelands within the 17-mile corporate boundary area of Whittier. And I'm sure some of you have been to Whittier. The head of the bay is deep, requires minimum initial dredging in the event of development due to the fact that sedimentation on the north side of the bay is virtually non-existent. And there's also an existing rail spur from the Alaska Railroad that runs along the city road, which terminates near the head of the bay. We have many acres available for development, and many more may be available by us, the city, just simply moving its well site. I think one of my most important facts I'd like to point out, and I think we're all aware of it regarding ports, our Alaska challenge is we need to be prepared for any eventuality that's been ignored for many years, if not decades. No one port can provide the transportation and freight security that we need and should be required. We hope you recognize this fact and consider Whittier as a viable option as an answer as you move forward with your deliberations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Thank you for your work history as well in Seward and now in Whittier. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Hunt about the port of Whittier? Seeing none, I will have some questions for myself. What do you get state funding for your port? How much, and what do you use it for if you do get it?
Thank you for asking that. We have received $0 regarding what I would call port improvement or major improvement. At this time, historically, our small boat harbor, which is pretty small, has received a $500,000 Harbor Match grant, and that was a 75-25% responsibility to Whittier, and that's been all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Do you get a lot of freight through there to the railroad? I know that there was some talk of propane or different kinds of gases coming up from Canada and such, and that Whittier was going to be the site of where the train cars would be transferred. Is any of that kind of stuff happening right now in Whittier? Not necessarily propane.
Thank you for asking. That's a good question. Give me just quickly a chance to expand on that. With Linden, Alaska Marine Lines, they partner with the railroad to transport, you know, material, freight, and also hazardous material right through the middle of town. We are partners with all of our agencies and companies in Whittier. In the long run, I think this would be, the private-public partnership term is kind of overused, but I could see an opportunity here in the future where we could move, in a partnership relationship, three and four times faceted, over to the north side of the bay and remove a lot of that dangerous material away from our city center and from our tourist district where our cruise ships come in. And this year we are bringing even larger ships in, the big ships. So that's also always a concern of the back of the mind. But, at times we just kind of have to close a blind eye because it's the reality of, where we live right now.
Thank you. You mentioned you'd want to be the home port or a port site for the ferry. What does that exactly mean?
Well, right now, the Aurora, depending on, which ferry, is in dry dock, but it is not currently home ported in Whittier. And if it was home ported in Whittier, it'll address some of the housing issues, being elsewhere. For instance, if it was in Cordova, Hoonah, Valdez, economically, it would actually make more sense, in our view, for it to be home ported, when it's not in its travels over, in its overnight for the crew, for it to be, stationed home ported there in Whittier due to for economic reasons, for housing mainly, and for easy transportation out, to the city and to the airport.
Right. Another question I just had. Representative Stutes has a question. Go, Chair Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair, I heard you mention AML. Did you say that AML delivers or comes into the Port of Whittier?
Linden, the Alaska Marine Lines, the acronym, the abbreviation is AML. They operate our heavy freight dock. They're right near downtown.
Follow up.
And they receive and ship, the heavy freight and materials in and out and through the tunnel.
Thank you. Do you have any other freight lines that use the Port of Whittier?
That is our central. We do have smaller barges that come and go. They're right there in that area as well. It's literally a blank slate because it's pretty unique. As I pointed out, on the north side of the bay, it is deep water. It's a secure area, and there's access immediately to the tunnels and to the highway, which makes it kind of unique.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. What if I'm sailing up from, say, Seattle on the Inside Passage? What's the first or closest port for me? Say, Whittier,
you would like
Seward.
In our run, it runs Valdez and then down Cordova, and then it makes the northern loop across Prince William Sound.
And you'd be after Valdez, or
right? We're the western gateway to the Sound.
Okay, and one last question from me, kind of a historical one. Was Whittier during World War II? Was it a submarine base? I'm getting nodding heads in the audience here. Was it a sub port at one time?
Would that be officially or unofficially?
Yeah, unofficially, off the record, of course.
we were for many types of vessels, yes.
Okay. keeping his cards close. Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Seeing no more questions from the or comments from the committee, thank you for calling in, and thank you for what you do down there in Whittier. And we'll move to our next presenter, and that would be Brennan Hickok, Assistant City Manager, and Norm Regis, Harbor Master at the Port of Seward. Gentlemen, welcome to the House Transportation Committee. If you can identify yourselves for the record and present your testimony. And is there a PowerPoint? Did you guys bring one? Okay, let me take a brief at ease while we set that up. Back on, and you guys can introduce yourselves and give us your presentation.
Hi there, my name is Brennan Hickok. I'm the Assistant City Manager for the City of Seward.
Mr. Chair, I'm Norm Regis, Harbor Master in Seward.
We appreciate the invite today. It's an honor to represent Seward today, giving you a presentation on the ports, harbors, and docks. We have three different entities that operate in the City of Seward. We have the Seward Boat Harbor, which is on the west side of the bay. We have the Alaska Railroad, which operates our port. That's also on the west side of the bay. And then we have the Seward Marine Industrial Center, which is on the east side of the bay. A brief introduction. The Seward Township was established in 1903, and it became incorporated city in 1912. The original harbor was on the central coastline, and the railroad facility was on the south end. After the earthquake of 1964, it was rebuilt in a more permanent, appropriate location, protected from the southern wind. The Port of Seward is connected to Alaska by rail, road, and air. It's 125 highway miles south of Anchorage, 114.3 rail miles south of Anchorage, and 470.3 rail miles south of Fairbanks. It is also a year-round, ice-free, deep-water port. Here's an interesting historical picture of Seward. Let's see if we can make that. You can see this was taken in 1906. We have the railroad facility there on the south end of town. This is facing north. Here's another historical picture. You can see the railroad facility on the south end of town there. And then kind of towards the right-hand side, a little bit up along the central coastline, that's the original harbor of Seward. All of this was, in fact, washed out by the 1964 earthquake and tsunami.
Is that thing on the very bottom of your picture, is that kind of where the Marine Center would be right now? Am I looking, or is that the other side?
That's the other. This is the south side.
Okay.
So the Marine Center now is up north, kind of at the top of your screen there.
Okay. Thank you.
So this was taken after the quake. This is in 1965. You can see the harbor that's being developed there, and then the railroad terminal also to the left of that. Seward's harbor currently has 562 slips. 512 of those slips have electricity. It's dredged to negative 15 feet MLLW. It has over 5,000 feet of linear moorage, and the slip range is from 32 to 100 feet. We have two fish processing plants.
Representative Stutes.
Yep.
What's MLLW?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, it's a mean low low water.
I had to look that up this morning too. So there's two fish processing plants on that side of the bay. The process is about 27 million pounds of fish annually, worth about $42 million.
And they're both operating right now, obviously.
Question?
Representative Story.
Yes. What is the demand for the slips?
Through the chair, Representative Story. The demand for the slips, so the 32-foot range, usually about 6 months or so. When you get up into 40s and 60s and 75s, it goes ranges from 2 years to 4 years for like the 90 footers. There's not too many 90 footers. Mostly are those day cruisers, and they tend to just renew them and, you know, don't give up their slips. But
Thanks.
Here's a more recent shot of the Seward Harbor. As you can see, the slips are pretty much full. And on the bottom of your screen, there is the Coast Guard Mustang. The Seward was granted a new fast response cutter that we'll be receiving in 2023. And we're still working with the Coast Guard right now on developing uplands in order to accommodate that. Ongoing projects in the harbor. Right now, we're conducting a boat launch rebuild on the south side, and that was a $2.7 million grant, which includes some matching funds from ADF&G. And then, as I mentioned, the upland development to accommodate the Coast Guard fast response cutter, which is due to arrive in 2023. That was a $31 million appropriation from the feds. We have two floats that we're seeking to replace, and that is L and K float. And then we have a 50-ton travel lift washdown pad that we would like to construct on the west side of the bay.
And I'll ask you, since you brought up funding, how much state funds? It sounds like you got fish and game funding. What other state funding have you received? And
the Seward Marine Industrial Center received $29.5 million grants from the state of Alaska. That was two $10 million appropriations and then one $5.9 million appropriation.
And was that used for the industrial?
Yeah.
What, I'm sorry, what's the full name of it?
The Seward Marine Industrial Center, and we'll get to that here in a little bit. Yeah.
And through the chair, also, so within this small boat harbor itself, we use the facility grant program that's been going on since the state sold the harbors back to the municipalities. So they started that program. That's how we've been slowly rebuilding our the harbor. So we have to have, you know, shovel ready project money in hand before we go to the state for the 50% match. So hopefully with that 50% match facility grant program can keep going. So.
Thank you. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. I see that you have a 50-ton travel lift washdown pad. Do you have a travel lift there in Seward? And how big is your travel lift?
Yes, through the chair, we do have two travel lifts. We have one on the west side of the bay in our harbor, which is a 50-ton travel lift, and then on the east side of the bay at the Seward Marine Industrial Center is a 330-ton travel lift.
Oh, thank you.
Through the chair, one more thing about, we do have a washdown pad at the 330-ton travel lift, which was paid for with EVOS money.
EVOS is
Exxon Valdez oil spill.
Oh, thank you. I knew someone would know that. Representative Drummond, then Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Upland development to accommodate the Coast Guard cutter. Is that away from the harbor? Is that fill? Tell me what you mean by upland development.
To the chair. The upland development is going to be whatever facilities the Coast Guard necessitates for their new fast response cutter and support maintenance team. So that's going to be a new building. It's going to could potentially be a new dock. It could potentially mean new development in the, if they choose to locate at the Seward Marine Industrial Center.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Through the chair. What's the largest size vessel that the 330-ton lift can pull out?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes. So we have lifted the Klondike. If you know, that's from the Whittier Prince William Sound area, and that's 145 feet. We did lift a 150-footer. It was one of the boats from the that. One of the shows there anyways, but this part pretty much is 150. We can lengthwise, we get over that, then we're, it's hard to turn with the travel lift. So, but we, the yard's big enough that we've actually made it work for all those different size vessels.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Here's another photo of the harbor. This is on the west side of the bay facing south. Seward's port is a port operated by the Alaska Railroad. It's a 328-acre port, and 75 of those acres are dock facilities. There's freight docks, passenger jocks, and a loading facility. As many of you may know, the loading facility has been inactive since 2016. It was primarily used for coal export. The market for coal has significantly declined and forced that facility to shut down, but it is still in Seward, and the railroad has said that they could revamp that facility in a short manner of time if the market adjusted so.
Representative Stutes, question?
Yes, thank you. Why did Seward determine that they no longer wanted the Alaska Marine Highway system to dock there?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, I believe they pulled themselves out. I'm not sure of the whole story, but I know we wanted to keep it, but the state pulled it out, or whoever was in charge at the time pulled it out of there. I don't remember the whole story.
And that was a ferry that went to Homer? I mean, Kodiak.
Kodiak,
Tustin. Yeah, sorry.
The Alaska Railroad.
Representative Story?
Yeah, it would be interesting to get that information.
Mm-hmm. The Alaska Railroad also operates the cruise ship port. In 2018, we saw 70 cruise ships in Seward, and we have 82 scheduled for 2019. This serves about 200,000 cruise ship customers annually. In 2015, the port managed 4.29 million tons of freight, which serviced 40 different freight customers. This is 2015, so that number has significantly dropped since the coal facility shut down.
So most of that freight was coal, that was export freight.
Mm-hmm.
And do you do any import freight that comes into Seward and gets on the railway and goes north?
Yes.
And is that freight different than, say, what goes into Whittier or Anchorage?
Not that I'm aware.
Same type of thing.
Yes.
Just some people are choosing to come into Seward.
Yeah, Seward is the gateway to the Kenai Peninsula, so some shipping options are cheaper to come through Seward if you're going into the Kenai Peninsula.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. And Representative Story.
What fees or what economic benefits do you get from the cruise ships being in port, coming through?
There's a number of, through the chair, there's a number of economic benefits to have the cruise ships in Seward. One, obviously, is the head tax, which is a 5% mm-hmm. tax.
Sure.
The other is the folks that come to Seward and spend their money. We are a turnaround port. We're not a port of call. So a lot of those cruise ships passengers do get on the train immediately and leave Seward. Mm-hmm. But there are a handful of cruise ships that have 24 to 48-hour stays in Seward before they leave. So the economic impact of having those folks in town is significant.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
So this is a picture that represents the perfect usage of a port. We have a cruise ship in town. There's some freight activity on the east end, and then you can see at the end of the coal loading facility there that there's a coal ship being loaded up. The Seward Marine Industrial Center, otherwise known as SMIC, is another city-operated entity on the east side of the bay. It received three grants totaling $25.9 million from the state of Alaska since 2012. It currently has over 1,000 feet of linear moorage. There's a 430-foot barge landing on the north dock, and the north dock is dredged to negative 25 feet MLLW, and the basin itself is negative 21 feet MLLW. This is a good aerial of SMIC currently. You can see on the very bottom of your screen there is the new breakwater that was installed as a part of this grant program. And then the north dock is the one in the middle of the screen, kind of to the left there, that runs east and west. And then there's the fisherman's float, which runs north to south, which is just to the right of that in this photo. There's a fish processing plant to the right of the fisherman's float there, and then to the right of that, hopefully you all are following, is our 330-ton lift pit. The furthest item on the right there is the synchro lift, which can lift 5,000 tons.
So this is on the opposite side.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in, if you're at the boat harbor, it's across the bay.
Correct.
Okay, I've seen it. And so what is it? Industrial center. What are you looking to? What happens over there exactly? I guess.
Currently over there, there's a lot of marine support businesses. We have JAG, which is, they do large vessel repair and maintenance. And then there's five or six other marine support businesses over there. There's the Shoreside Petroleum tank farm. There's, as I mentioned, the fish processing. There's boat storage. There's fiberglass work, those types of. This area during the winter is very active. During the summer, it's not very active.
So utilizing the lifts.
Exactly.
And so on.
Yep.
And there's no rail to that side?
Currently, there's no rail to that side of the bay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And through the chair, a couple of times, AFTEC, Classification Technical Center, has a fire training center over there, which encompasses with the city's fire training centers, with all the different fire departments come down to use also, and the training for all the AFTEC students for the getting to marine-related fields.
So as I mentioned earlier, there's a 10-ton crane located at the North Dock. There's also 10 acres of storage at the North Dock. We have 25 acres of upland storage, and then, as I mentioned, the 5,000-ton synchro lift. There's a 330-ton travel lift and pit, as well as the fish processing plant over at SMIC. This is a picture facing west. We had this oil rig in town for a couple of years.
I think sometimes these aerial photos make things look kind of small, but
right, yeah,
I mean, it's an oil rig right there.
That's right.
It's like,
yeah,
and those boats are probably pretty big that are sitting on the ground there.
And if you look to the left of that, you'll see the fish processing plant is the big white building, and then you'll see a boat inside our 330-ton lift in the pit there. And then the synchro lift to the far left, you'll see the size of vessel that comes out of those. And that operation, as I mentioned, is operated by JAG. So here's the industry that's over at SMIC right now. There's JAG Industrial, which is a large marine vessel repair. They're currently working on a Coast Guard cutter spar. Alaska Logistics is marine vessel repair. There's Raybo, which is fiberglass and marine vessel repair. Exa Marine. There's Hung Tough Nets, which is a fishing net repair company, the AVTEC training, Fire Training Center. Communications North is a communications repair and installation group. The Shoreside Petroleum Tank Farm, Seward Marine, which is storage, and Polar Seafoods is the seafood processing plant that's over in SMIC.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drummond.
Just a point of interest, I think, in the at the very top center of this photo, isn't that the Spring Creek Correctional Facility?
Not that picture yet.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. In this photo, yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, way at the top there.
Yeah, way at the top. That's the maximum security prison.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So the future of SMIC. We seek to increase cargo handling and capacity for Alaskan bound cargo. We've started the conversation about a rail extension to connect SMIC to the railroad, which would put us at a competitive advantage in terms of Alaskan bound cargo. We'd like to continue expansion of the maritime support businesses at SMIC and maximize the moorage capacity. We've also been discussing with the Coast Guard of where they're going to locate their new cutter. One of the options is over at SMIC, and that could significantly increase some of the activity and infrastructure over there as well.
would cargo coming into the railroad port where the coal facility is, would that not, you talk about expanding cargo, SMIC would be a better location than the other side, or does the coal side work for anything but coal right now, I guess my question.
Yeah, so the railroad facility does manage quite a bit of cargo, and they do have a better facility today to handle those types of ships. We would need significant investments on the Seward Marine Industrial Center in order to increase the cargo activity and export and import from that side of the bay.
And that would only be if you had more demand?
Correct, yes.
And the cargo coming in now is mostly staying on the peninsula. In other words, if it's going Anchorage or north of Anchorage, it would ship into Anchorage typically.
That would be my best guess.
Okay,
yes.
All right.
That's the end of our presentation. We'll entertain any questions anybody nice. Has.
Nice picture.
Yeah.
Any questions from committee members? Seeing none. Thank you. Thank you very much for.
Thank you for having us. Yeah. We really appreciate it.
See next. I'm going to call brief at ease. Call the committee back to order. And next up, we have on the line Jim either Yeager or Jaeger representing the Port of Alaska in Anchorage. And we have a PowerPoint presentation. So, Jim, if you could identify yourself for the record, and we can present your slides down here.
Okay, hello, I'm Jim Jaeger from the Port of Alaska. I'm the External Affairs Director here. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Yes, thanks for calling in. And we heard from the ports of Whittier and from the port of Seward. And so we want to hear from the port in Anchorage that's also sometimes called the Port of Alaska. So what?
That is correct. We are the Port of Alaska. We are a municipality of Anchorage owned and operated facility. It serves our community, the whole state of Alaska, and the nation. The port actually opened up in 1961 to support regional economic development, and the Anchorage Assembly renamed it in October of 2017, Port of Alaska, to reflect our regional, state, and national significance.
Okay.
If you, I guess, do I just tell you to flip the slide?
Yep, you can go ahead and just say next. We're on just the title
okay.
page, so we probably should
sure, say next. Yep.
Okay, thanks.
And I'm not really seeing the slideshow. Do you have the globe up?
Yep, virtual island.
Okay, so I want to start by pointing out the fact that our state is a virtual island, and our economy relies upon marine transport. If you look at all of the cargo that comes into our state, 90% of all of Alaska's inbound cargo is marine freight. That means it gets delivered either on a ship or a barge. Air and truck carriers each account for a little less than 5% of the state's inbound cargo freight. Also, our state's biggest industries, whether you're talking oil, tourism, fishing, mining, timber, all rely upon marine commerce. But we have a bit of a challenge with ports in that there is no Alaska government department or official who's responsible for oversight, advocacy, planning, or funding of Alaska seaports and related marine infrastructure. It's an outlier in our transportation system. If you look at the modes of transportation, highway, air, rail, pipeline, and marine, the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is responsible for highway system. In fact, it has three highway regions. It's responsible for the air system, more than 300 aviation facilities. It's responsible for marine harbors, and harbors are different than ports in that harbors are basically places where you store and dock boats, as opposed to ports are places where cargo moves across the dock. And it's also responsible for the ferry system. We also have State Department a state organization in the form of the Alaska Railroad. It's a state-owned corporation that's responsible for all the state's rail transport, DNR's Division of Oil and Gas has a state pipeline coordinator responsible for all pipeline systems, but we have no state entity or individual that is responsible for Alaska ports or cargo ports. This challenge is exacerbated by the fact that the state's ports are owned and operated by a variety of local government, quasi-government, and private interests. So there's really very little coordination between the ports on a statewide level.
Do other?
If you want to go to the next slide.
I have a question. Do most states have a statewide port authority? I know like New York City has, they have a port authority. Is that a state run?
It varies from state to state, and there is not a model that you can say this is the norm.
Just a
Representative Drummond.
I grew up in New York City, and interestingly, the port authority in New York is of New York and New Jersey. You have two states cooperating. I always thought that was fascinating because we have the borough of the Matanuskas who sit in a borough across the water from Anchorage, and I always thought it would be smart of them to cooperate on a port authority. If two states can do it, I don't know why two boroughs couldn't do it. Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So do we have the next slide up, the one that says Alaska's primary inbound cargo port?
Yep.
Or cargo handling? Okay, so Port of Alaska is the state's primary inbound cargo handling facility. We handle about half of all of the state's inbound marine freight. That was about 3.9 million tons of fuel and freight in 2018. Half of the freight that crosses our dock keeps on moving to final destinations outside of Anchorage, statewide, including down in southeast where you are. And Port of Alaska's cargo business is very stable. It's closely linked to the state's population. Our cargo activity tends to cycle up as the state's population grows, and it declines with the state's population. So they're pretty much in lockstep. If you want to go to the next slide. So today,
Mr. Jager, you mentioned that a lot of the freight that comes to Southeast, where we are in Juneau, comes through Anchorage. Is that correct?
So it goes freight, not a lot.
Okay.
And that's because of the cargo logistics. It is cheaper to send it back on backhaul than it is to send a vessel up, deliver, and then ship it back empty. So, for instance, avgas. Most of the state's avgas comes into Port of Alaska, and they will put it on a barge, and an empty barge that's going back to deliver avgas down along southeast on the return trip back down to Washington or wherever the barge started from.
Okay, interesting. Thank you.
So, versatility. Today, Port of Alaska is the state's most versatile port. We handle a wide variety of domestic and foreign cargo carriers. We have three general cargo terminals that have lift-on and lift-off capability, roll-on and roll-off capability, and break bulk capability. We have two petroleum terminals. We handle dry bulk cement. We have a dry barge landing, and we do cruise ships. We had 11 cruise ship landings in 2018. They'll be back this year in 2019, and we're also going to have the Queen Elizabeth here. Interestingly, we are not the biggest port in the state by tonnage. We're actually the biggest inbound cargo facility in the state. We're the fourth biggest port by tonnage behind Valdez, Nikiski, and Red Dog Mines facility up in the Chukchi Sea. Those are all export facilities. Next slide. So cargo handling logistics and efficiencies are driven by proximity to markets, infrastructure, and transportation connections. Port of Alaska is at the state's population and business level. It also leverages, or our docks leverage and are leveraged by hundreds of millions of dollars worth of private freight-related infrastructure. Things like we have a 125-acre cargo handling yard. We have 60,000 tons of cement storage on the port. We have 3.4 million barrels of fuel storage on the port. If you want to go to the next slide, we're also we are the state's intermodal connection point for cargo distribution. Port of Alaska is where all the various cargo transportation modes come together. As you're driving into our main gate, you have to drive right past the Alaska Marine Line and North Star Barge Terminals that service Western Alaska. The Alaska Highway System connects to Port of Alaska. 60% of the state's population lives within a two-hour drive of this dock. 75% of all Alaskans live on the Anchorage Connected Road System. We have multiple rail connections on the port. A little more than 2 miles of rail track are actually on the port, and the railroad's main cargo yard is at grade and immediately adjacent to the port. Ted Stevens International Airport and Jay Bear Runways are both within sight of our dock. And we have a valve yard and related pipelines that connect Jay Bear, Ted Stevens International Airport, the Nikiski Petroleum Dock and Refinery, our 3.4 million barrels of fuel, and then lots of truck and rail loading racks that can distribute to the entire state. All of this connected infrastructure gives our port more inbound cargo handling capacity than every other port in South Central Alaska combined. Want to go to the next slide, please? Functions. So Port of Alaska today serves three core functions. One is what I'll call commerce. That's the statewide cargo services and economic development for the state. This function generates virtually all of the port's revenue, and that revenue pays for all of the port's operations. The port has been cash flow positive ever since the 1964 earthquake, and no tax dollars or other public money go to support ongoing port operations. Our second function is national defense. We're a Department of Defense U.S. Commercial Strategic Seaport. And our third function is earthquake resiliency, disaster response, and disaster recovery. Port of Alaska is key to every state and federal disaster response plan. And every time they do a drill, the drill fails if Port of Alaska fails. Next slide, please. Oh, commerce.
Regarding earthquake, what if there's earthquake damage to the Port of Alaska? I mean, is it particularly vulnerable in your location there?
Well, we are in a vulnerable area. We survived the November earthquake with no operational failure. We had one ship at dock it was a tanker at dock when the earthquake hit. We kept operating, the port never closed. The ship unhooked during the earthquake and stopped operations. It stayed at dock while we tested all of our lines to make sure we didn't have any damage caused by the earthquake, and they finished offloading the next day after we had tested and approved our lines. So we actually had no operational loss during the November earthquake. That said, we dodged a bullet. It could have been a lot worse. We do a lot of work to stay as resilient as we can, but we're also an aging facility, and I'll talk about that more in a little bit.
This picture in front of us with the ship Overseas Boston in it, that structure to the right, what's the support structure there? Is that ice?
That's a wharf on piles, and what you're looking at, we call those our corn dogs. That's basically ice buildup on the piling.
Okay.
I believe this picture was probably taken in January, if I recall, and that's about how much ice we typically get built up on the piles at that point in the wintertime.
Okay. Thank you. We're on the next.
So do we want to look? Can we go to the next slide that says commerce?
Yep, we're there.
Okay. So as far as the commerce function goes, we serve a commerce function for the municipality, for the state, and for the nation. We're in the business of bringing freight and fuel into the state for the residents, for Alaska businesses, and for our economy. As I said before, commerce generates virtually all of our revenue. 85% of all Alaskans receive a direct benefit from Port of Alaska in that they use on a regular basis goods that have crossed our dock. And the entire state receives indirect benefits. For example, 90% of the liquid fuel brought into South Central Alaska crosses our dock, including most of the jet fuel used at Jay Bear and Ted Stevens International Airport. I said a minute ago, virtually all of the avgas used in the state comes across our dock. Cement, we have a huge cement handling facility that Alaska Basic Industries owns. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% of the cement used in the state crosses our dock. If you look at the three biggest cement users in the state in 2018, first was Liberty Energy Project in the shallow waters off of the North Slope that's being developed. Second is Eielson Air Force Base F-35 infrastructure. And the third is Pogo Gold Mine. So you have three huge economic development projects in other parts of the state that use our dock and our facilities. Can you go to the next slide, please, on national defense?
We're on it.
So national defense, we are a U.S. commercial strategic seaport that supports the Department of Defense missions in Alaska, the Pacific Rim, and the Arctic. About 20% of our cargo is military-related. However, the strategic seaport status has more to do with than just daily cargo that we move across that benefits the military. It means we also have to have facilities available on very short notice to support deployments. So if the military decides they're going to deploy to some country or some battlefield and half of the facilities in Fairbanks and Anchorage need to go out on ships, we basically make the docks available for them. We have to provide 2,200 feet of horizontal feet of dock space, 25 acres of yard, ready for their exclusive use. Next slide, please. So this is the earthquake resiliency response and disaster recovery. So we are a key piece of state and federal disaster infrastructure. And as I said, virtually every disaster response plan relies upon Port of Alaska being functioning. This raises, as we're moving into replacing the dock, it potentially raises the cost of the dock in order to make sure that we're earthquake resilient. And if we want to ask why does resilience matter, it's very important to the entire state because our state is a just-in-time deliver state. Depending on where you are, we have 6 to 10 days food supply in the state at any given time. So if the supply chain gets broken, Alaskans will get hungry very quickly. I've heard some people go, well, you know, if the port closes, we'll just shift over to air. We'll be fine. Well, we'll ignore the extra expense. Right now, Ted Stevens, depending on which table you look at or which who you believe, Ted Stevens is the fifth busiest cargo airport on the planet, has about 500 wide-body flights landing each week. In order to replace Port of Alaska's sea lift capability with airlift, you would have to have an additional 700 flights into Ted Stevens every week to replace what comes into Port of Alaska. Upper Cook Inlet is tsunami-proof. During the 64 earthquake, Port of Alaska was the only South Central Alaska port that survived the earthquake and the tsunamis. And as a result, it played a key role in reconstruction. And that's really why the state's main port moved from Seward to Anchorage was because of the earthquake. Next slide, please. So our challenge is that Anchorage's half-century-old docks are suffering a slow-motion disaster of corrosion and obsolescence. The facility has long exceeded its 35-year design life. As I said, the first dock opened in 1961. The aging piles have lost up to three-quarters of their original thickness near the mudline, and they're unlikely to survive another significant earthquake, meaning like a 64-size earthquake. Wharf pile repair started in 2004, where we've been putting steel jackets on the piles to reinforce the corrosion. Unfortunately, those repairs are one-time repairs that last 10 to 15 years. Because that 10 to 15 years is running out, means we have about 9 years left until we're going to have to start closing docks due to lack of load-bearing capacity. And that's assuming there is no earthquake. Next slide, please. So the Port of Alaska Modernization Program is a program that basically will replace our aging docks and related infrastructure to improve safety and operational efficiency, to accommodate modern shipping operations, and to improve resiliency. The modern shipping operations, for example, these docks were originally built back in the 1960s when vessels were a lot smaller. So, for instance, our low mean depth is 35 feet. we anticipate that the new docks will be 40 or 45 feet in order to accommodate bigger ships. Seismic resiliency, back when the original dock was built, there were no seismic standards for marine facilities. The new docks, we've done extensive studies, and they will be designed to survive a much bigger earthquake. You should know that the port modernization program is not an expansion plan. We have plenty of dock. It's a replacement plan. Right now, we're functioning at 35 to 40% of our dock capacity. Best practices experts will tell you that a port shouldn't expand its docks until it's at 70% capacity. So we can almost double the state's population before we really need to expand the docks. Our challenge is that the clock is ticking, though, because we're into the last decade of life of this dock. Next slide, please. So we have started our initial construction. In 2018, we started shoreline stabilization for where we're going to build a new petroleum and cement terminal. That area, actually in this photograph, you can see what they're doing is they're doing what's called deep soil mixing. They basically dug out the soils that were put in there years ago and were subject to seismic instability. They mixed cement with it and let it harden up so that it will be a really solid place to tie the new dock trestle into. And in November, the earthquake demonstrated that the engineer's plan worked because there was no damage in that area. If you look at the soils on either side of that area that was stabilized, there was some cracking and the start of liquefaction in those areas. The modernization plan is basically going to build a new dock, a new petroleum and cement terminal, about 400 yards south of our existing dock, and then it will move north with a demolish, build model so that we can keep the whole facility open and keep servicing Alaska throughout our construction period.
So is this construction on the dock, or this is, because you talked about the dock being running out of life, but is this dock construction, or is this a...
Basically our docks are well beyond their 35-year lifespan, and there is no more repairing them. They need to be replaced. So what our plan is we're going to more or less replace the facility that we have now, but we're going to move about 400 yards south of where we are, and we'll be about 150 feet farther out into the ocean so that we're in deeper water to accommodate deeper draft vessels. And then we will start building. We'll build the southmost dock. We'll then move north, demolish one of the existing docks, move the traffic that's there to the new southmost dock, and then proceed north over the next roughly 8 years with a demo build model until the whole facility has been replaced. And that way we keep all of the terminals, or the same number of terminals, operational so that we can keep getting food and feeding Alaskans.
Thank you.
And that's my main presentation. I guess there are going to be questions probably about the port modernization program. The replacement cost, well, a couple of things about the port modernization cost. First of all, please do not confuse it with the failed port intermodal expansion project from the early 2000s. That was a completely different type of project that basically caused it created about $250 million worth of repair work that we have to do, and it is not a new dock. It was initially meant to replace our docks as they were aging out, and it was going to expand the Port of Alaska far beyond what our business model really requires or what our market requires. That project failed, and we are currently in litigation to get damages to pay for the repair work. The port modernization program is simply a replacement project. Our idea is that based on what the users have told us they want, the project could range up to $2 billion. I expect that it will be quite a bit less than that. simply because the state can't afford that much. And we are working toward what we're calling a beneficiary pays model, so that the beneficiaries of the various improvements are the ones who will actually pay for it.
And who do you mean by that exactly?
Well, so for instance, if we're replacing the petroleum and cement terminal, the bulk of the expense, if we end up revenue bonding for it, the expense would be paid back with tariffs and fees that are associated with the petroleum and cement terminal, so that petroleum and cement users would be the ones who are ultimately paying for the new dock. So that every time you buy a gallon of gas, a portion of that would go toward paying for the new dock. And we would repay the revenue bonds with the tariffs that we're collecting on cement and fuel that crosses the dock.
So the tariffs would be charged to the commercial customers that are using the dock.
Correct. And then they will end up passing them on to Alaskans, the ultimate customers.
Sure.
Now, the challenge here is that we're a little bit different than most other ports, say lower 48 ports. If we were the Port of Tacoma and we wanted to build a petroleum and cement terminal or a cargo dock or any other dock, well, first of all, Port of Tacoma ships cargo both inbound and outbound. So somewhere in the neighborhood of half of your tariffs are being charged to outbound cargo, so that ultimately it's being paid by somebody in Asia or up here in Alaska, as opposed to by somebody in the state of Washington. And then with inbound cargo, a significant portion, more than half of Port of Tacoma's inbound cargo, gets put onto trucks and trains that continues east and ends up in places like Omaha. So again, you have people outside of Washington who are ultimately paying those tariffs. Here in Alaska, virtually all of our freight is inbound. Port of Alaska has very little outbound freight. And then all of the freight that comes inbound stays in the state. That means that Alaskans are going to be the ones carrying the bill or paying the bill. So then the question becomes, well, what's the most efficient way for them to pay the bill? They could pay it as a cargo tariff, so that every time they buy a bucket of blueberries at the grocery store or a gallon of gas at the gas station, they're paying a little bit extra to pay for the dock. Or we could say, you know, that's going to tilt the cargo playing field in a way that doesn't benefit Alaskans. And here's how that could work. So if we raise our tariff on inbound cargo a certain amount per ton, what's going to happen is you're going to look at, for instance, grocery stores, and they're going to go, we're bringing produce in, and even with the tariff, produce is the cheapest way. Ships at Port of Alaska are the cheapest way to get fresh produce into the state in a timely fashion. So they'll pay the extra tariff in order to bring their blueberries or their lettuce in and get it here in a timely fashion. On the other hand, some other importers, say a car dealer, will look at it and go, you know, I can bring my cars in on, for instance, a barge. A barge takes 10 days instead of 3 days that a ship takes to get here. But, you know, I can save a couple of $100 per car, and they will shift and start bringing their vehicles up on barges. The problem is Port of Alaska still has to pay for the same dock. Now, we don't have as much tonnage coming across the dock, so we would end up having to raise our tariffs even more on the goods that are coming across the dock, so that your head of lettuce, instead of going up, say, a nickel, suddenly goes up 50 cents. And, you know, that could create all sorts of economic peril for the state. One way to avoid that is if you said, okay, this is a statewide facility, we're going to use state tax dollars to help pay for the new facility. That would distribute the costs without tilting the current cargo playing field.
Thank you. I'm not sure which state tax dollars you're referring to, but just to back up,
tax dollars meaning state money, whether it be, you know, the revenue could come from any state tax source.
Let me back you up. When you mentioned the barge, the cars coming up on barges, and that would not go across your docks, And is that because they go to
the barges that are coming into this into South Central Alaska are going to be coming into Whittier.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. So you guys don't do a lot of barge traffic. You do mostly ship traffic. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. I'm not being a bit of a layman on that. I see a ship in the picture with a bunch of containers on it, but a barge, which also hauls containers, is mostly not going to the port of Anchorage. I'm sorry, Alaska.
Yeah, we basically do not get any containerized barge traffic.
Okay. And we have
most of the barges that we deal with are fuel barges from Valdez.
Okay. And we have some questions from the committee. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Chair Wohl. So essentially, are you asking for the state to support the Port of Alaska?
At some point, we do have the municipality of Anchorage is asking for support on the new dock. The legislature gave $20 million toward the new petroleum cement terminal and our port modernization program last year. We are moving forward with the construction of the new petroleum cement terminal now, but we do not have full funding yet. And full funding, well, depending on how much we get from state money, that's going to impact the size of the tariffs that we have to levy on petroleum and cement.
Quick follow-up. So I guess my question or my thought process is if Anchorage is going to ask for the state to support, I'm not sure what percentage of the project you're asking, but there should be some sort of a either partnership with the state where the state has some ownership in the port, or I mean, it doesn't make sense for us to dump a ton of money into infrastructure that the state doesn't own.
And we would be happy to talk to you about that. Now, part of what we're talking about, or part of our challenge, is if we're working on a beneficiary pays model, the Port of Alaska, we have our commerce function, but we have, you know, for instance, our disaster response function. In order to spend the extra money to make the petroleum cement terminal, I'll use that dock in particular because the plan is at 100% plan level, in order to make that facility to the, I'll call them the super seismic standards for earthquake resiliency, you add somewhere in the neighborhood of 15% to the overall dock cost. That does not make the facility any more efficient, or it doesn't deliver any benefits to the petroleum companies or to the cement companies, because a regular commerce level dock will serve their needs just fine. So who pays that extra 15%? Well, if that disaster recovery resilient and earthquake resilience is a public benefit, that should probably come from a public money, whether it be the state or the federal government.
How much state money have you received so far?
$20 million last year on this for this dock.
And then you referenced the $250 million repair, and that was just some work that was done that was in need of repair afterwards, I guess.
I'm sorry. The $250 million number, that's for the repair work from the failed port intermodal expansion program.
Was that a state fund
project?
Was that state funded or the
failed
city
project from the early 2000s?
Was that the city of Anchorage that funded that?
That was a combination of state and federal funds, mostly federal funds. MARAD, the U.S. Department of Transportation's Maritime Administration, was the project manager of that project. The courts are deciding, gee, was it a poor design? Was it poor construction? Was it poor management? I can't tell you definitively what caused the problem. All I can tell you is that the project did not work, and we are currently in litigation with MARAD to recover the damages, being the amount of money we have to spend in order to fix the damage that they caused. Our challenge is that $250 million, which is part of the port intermodal expansion, which is part of the of our modernization program, only because the work has to be done in order to make room for our construction project. It won't actually generate any new revenue. It won't end up creating a facility that we can charge some tariff to use. As a result, our only way to pay for that piece of the project right now is with the MARAD litigation. But that's a completely separate piece than the petroleum cement terminal. And it's unrelated to our ask for state funds.
And what's your ask right now? You got $10 million last year. What's your ask right now?
We got $20 million last year.
Oh.
And at a minimum, we would like, last year, the legislature said that it would come back potentially with another $20 million this year, and I guess that would be our minimal ask. Depending on how you feel about the economic fallout that could be created from a large tariff increase, more state support would benefit the economy in that you would make cement and fuel handling less expensive.
Representative Rasmussen, then Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Chair Wohl. So do we have an update on the MARAD lawsuit, like a timeline, or I don't know where we're at with that. We keep hearing that it's in process, but I don't hear any dates or...
It is in process, and we anticipate that we will have a trial date late this year, so late 2019.
Thank you.
Representative Klayman?
With regard to the both the cement storage as well as the fuel storage, is that primarily being funded with contributions from those particular industries?
All of the state and cement storage facilities are privately owned and operated facilities. Port of Alaska is a landlord port. We do not, we will lease land, or in some cases it's actually the railroad that's leasing land to the fuel and cement companies, and then they build and operate, maintain and operate their own facilities. They're just leveraging the value of the dock.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
So I'm just looking at this slide that has the has a bunch of tanks on it, and I believe the only cement storage is the oval dome, and all the other white structures are all the fuel storage. Have I got that right, or am I getting that off?
You're close. We have 3.4 million barrels of fuel storage on the port, and that ranges from jet fuel to gasoline to, for instance, methanol, which is a product that the oil companies use to keep oil flowing during the wintertime. It's an anti-icing agent. So all of those petroleum products are controlled by, or all of those petroleum facilities are owned by private companies such as Crowley or Marathon. Alaska Basic Industries or Anchorage Sand and Gravel, the same company, owns the cement facilities. That dome is 40,000 tons of cement storage. They built that dome, I believe it was 3 years ago. It opened up. And then they have an additional 20,000 tons of silo and rail loading racks and truck loading racks.
But follow-up. The picture that you gave us on the slide that says initial construction underway actually doesn't show those silos.
No, the only thing you can see in that is the dome.
Okay, that's what I was pretty sure.
The silos are adjacent to the dome.
Okay.
So if I'm understanding this right, the whole upgrade of $2 billion would be something that you would basically fund with tariffs by raising the tariff on certain products that come across your docks. It would increase the price to all the end users, ultimately, and that's sort of the long-term goal initially.
Well, not quite. In that $2 billion is, that would be an all-in number if we built everything that back in 2015, we staged a number of design charrettes where we had all the various port users and interest groups come in and tell us what they needed or what the Port of Alaska needs to have. And then we basically came up with a conceptual design that answered all of those wants. Now, the trick is, you know, a lot of times you want more than you can actually afford. So that $2 billion number is for, depending on how you count it, 7-8 separate projects. Among those projects would be the new petroleum cement terminal, two new container terminals, an additional fuel terminal. It would be the Department of Defense strategic port needs. For instance, DOD wants us to have 2,200 feet of dock available for them. Well, our commercial needs are not anywhere near 2,200 feet, so who pays for that extra dock? We have the super seismic requirements where the earthquake specialists and the disaster recovery people want super resiliency built into the port. I'm calling that a separate piece of the project. We have the North Extension stabilization work. That's the repair project from the failed port intermodal expansion plan. And then we have a number of private user upgrades that the users would pay for. So, for example, Matson wants to replace our three 38-foot gauge cranes, cargo cranes, with four 100-gauge cranes. And the users would pay for those upgrades. So the funding sources are going to be across the board and different for each one of those pieces. The repair project from the failed port intermodal expansion project, we anticipate that the litigation will be the primary funding source. For the private user upgrades, those the users would pay for. For the basic commerce level docks, that's what we're looking for, either state money or port tariff increases to pay for.
Representative Drummond, and I want to remind everyone we have the Port of Bellingham online, and we only have about 12 or 13 minutes left. So I as much as I want, we could go longer with the Port of Anchorage, I'd like to move over to Bellingham as well. So Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jaeger, I'm curious as to why the Department of Defense couldn't pay for part of the renewal costs. And along with that question, does the Department of Defense currently pay port fees when they do use the port for deployment?
DOD pays normal tariffs for cargo that they move across the dock as part of their day-to-day operations. What they don't pay for is they don't pay to maintain the capability to give them 2,200 feet of dock on a short-term notice. This is actually an issue with strategic ports across the country. Pretty much every port that is a designated strategic port has complained about the fact that DOD puts these requirements on them, but then does not contribute revenue to help pay for those requirements for the construction, maintenance, and operation of that extra facility, if you will. With some ports, say a port of Tacoma, well, they're using more than 2,200 feet of dock on a day-to-day basis. So their day-to-day operations cover it, and if DOD suddenly needs a bunch of dock, they basically tell their normal users to go hang off on an anchor for a week or so while they handle DOD. In our case, we don't have day-to-day business that's filling the dock up, so it's a pure extra expense. The problem with why they're not contributing now is without earmarks, there is not a fund source that Department of Defense or any other federal department can designate funds to come to the Port of Alaska for.
Thank you.
And we are working on that. We've been chasing it hard. We just haven't been successful yet.
I'm going to have to end your portion, Mr. Jaeger, because we're running out of time, and we do have some from Bellingham. So thank you for your testimony and for all your information about the port in Anchorage. We heard from Seward. We heard from Whittier. All the three area in-state ports, and we are now going to go out of state to Washington. And sorry for the delay, Mr. Rob Fix is here. And if
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. It was really interesting to listen to the three Alaska ports and hear some of the same similar problems that we share down in Washington. I have some handouts here for the members, if I can.
Oh,
The Port of Bellingham has enjoyed a 30-year partnership with the Alaska Marine Highway System. We moved that business from the Port of Seattle, and we are your connection to the lower 48 states. When we made that move from Seattle to Bellingham, Bellingham built a $10 million terminal to host the facility, and that's the facility we're still using today. We think this is a very important connection to the lower 48. Military families use it to come up to Alaska when they're deployed or to move back down to the lower 48. The fishing community uses it heavily, not only to bring up personnel and supplies, but they also move fish product back down to the lower 48 through this ferry system. I understand that business inventory moves up to certain businesses in Alaska, and this lowers their cost of holding inventory because they have more frequent sailings. And construction equipment also moves back and forth between Washington and Alaska. Just your recreational traveler, if you're coming up with a gun or a dog, or if you have a DUI, it's very hard to drive up through Canada or go up to Prince Rupert. It's very easy to come through Bellingham. We don't require a passport or make you go through any of those security checks.
On that issue, that I've heard that before. If I can't drive through Canada and I get on the ferry, where do I get off so that I don't have to drive through Canada again?
In Ketchikan, Juneau, Skagway, Haines, all those are places that you can go from Bellingham and get off at those locations without showing a passport, or if you have a gun, you can take it to those.
But I'd still have to drive. If I'm going to Anchorage or Fairbanks, I'd have to go through Canada, I think.
If you can get a spot on the Cross Gulf.
Across Gulf, okay.
Yeah, there's a Cross Gulf connection okay. There that I'm less familiar with.
There is a route, okay. Yeah. I have taken the ferry up to Haines and driven up before, and it was great. It was a great ride.
I've heard it's a good one. I've got to try it someday. The economic benefits, we believe, are very large. The summer runs full with recreational travelers. This benefits your tourism economy, your hotels, your restaurants, and everyone, all the recreation that goes with that. The passengers that ride the ferry do end up in Fairbanks and in Anchorage. I heard yesterday or today that the second largest ticket buyers come from zip codes out of the Anchorage area for the ferry system. Bellingham does produce the greatest fare box revenue, so we're the largest revenue producer in the ferry system. And then, you know, Washington and Alaska have very strong economic ties. There's 113,000 jobs are tied to the commerce between the two states, not just regarding the ferry system, but that's our overall economies, just to show the strength of those connections. And then just finally, I'll say that the Port of Bellingham is a U.S. port, and we have U.S. employees that man these operations. And with that, I'll open up to any questions you may have.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Sorry to rush you in at the end of our meeting, but how much funding do you get from the state of Washington every year?
For the ferry system, none. We do have an airport that will occasionally have a project the state requires. We get some federal funding for our airport as well, as most airports do. The FAA has all kinds of mandates they want you to fulfill, and they do sometimes provide funding for those. We'll get the only other state money we get is for environmental cleanups. We have what's called a MOTCA account, Model Toxics Control Act. It's basically a state-funded a fund that pays for cleanups around the state with basically a tax on the barrel of oil.
And are the ports in Washington a state operation, or are they municipality-owned?
They're all individual municipalities, so the Port of Bellingham is governed by three independent elected officials. We're not part of a city, we're not part of the county, and we're not part of the state. Each port in Washington is very unique and has its own governance structure. There's basically two different types of structures. One is that the state runs all the ports, and then their governor appointees that act as the commissioners. And then there's the Washington model, which is more everyone's independent and elected instead of being appointed.
So each one has like a port authority or something to that effect?
That's correct. I report to three commissioners that are elected officials by the community in Whatcom County.
Oh, interesting. Any questions from Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So does Bellingham receive funds from Washington then for the port?
For those environmental cleanups I mentioned, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So I guess something that my constituents have asked is if Washington would consider a partnership with the Marine Highway in the state of Alaska. That's something that we could discuss further, because obviously we don't have a lot of time to get into that right now.
Absolutely willing to discuss that. I can't make decisions on behalf of the state, only on behalf of the Port of Bellingham. But
yeah.
We certainly have lobbyists, and we work with the state of Washington very closely on a number of items, and this is something I'd be happy to work with you on.
Awesome. Thank you.
Representative Story.
So if I understand this handout right, you're saying 20,000 Bellingham passengers a year average, and this is from 2015, ride the Marine Ferry system or contribute in some way for the 14.2 million?
And that's the average. I would point out that we've had years as been high as 30,000 people transiting back and forth on the ferry system.
Follow up.
And then this must be a similar study because you say in 2015 the route generated 21.5 million in revenue for Alaska Marine Highway with 70.3 million expenses. So obviously I can do the math, and there's my 14.2, it looks like. Or not. Oh, no, that's a different. Is that the same?
No, it should be the same. It should be 21 million of revenue less the 7 million of expenses.
Thank you. There it is, right there. Okay, thank you.
We need a bunch of Bellinghams to for our ferry system.
Follow up,
Representative Story.
Yeah, and how do you market, or how much do you spend marketing visiting Alaska?
Not as much as we should, and that's something we'd love to talk to you more about, is how we can use marketing dollars to the greatest benefit of both Alaska and Washington. Our marketing is very minimal at this point. Again, the summer runs are full, so there's not a lot of room to market those. So if we were going to market, I'd suggest shoulder seasons and the off season.
Representative Clement.
I just wanted to make sure I understand the relationship. The port is owned by Bellingham, but the Marine Highway has been leasing that portion of the port for some long period of time now.
Yeah, for 30 years. The port is owned by Whatcom County. We're a countywide port. Bellingham is a city within the county. But yes, sir, the state of Alaska leases our ferry terminal from us.
Follow up. And where was the Alaska Marine Highway terminal before Bellingham 30 years ago?
Seattle.
And then last follow-up.
Follow-up.
So actually, we actually are currently in partnership with your port for this particular facility, and the summer when it's full is when you're just, the cash register is running quite rapidly.
That is correct.
Is it two vessels that come down and run trips, or is it just one?
In the summertime, there's a second sailing. So we year-round, we have a Friday sailing, and then the summertime, we have a second sailing that I believe just goes to Ketchikan, and that's on Saturdays.
And last question, is it your understanding if we actually have more boats going from Bellingham up to Alaska that they would probably fill, if we had a third boat, they would probably fill that too?
In the summer months, for sure. Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Interesting. Well, when I rode the ferry, it was up from Seattle, so that's, I'm kind of dating myself.
So you hadn't there then?
Before 1988, I believe, right?
Yeah, I brought equipment to start a business in Fairbanks, and I drove it across country and put it on the ferry. So.
And that's a common story, people bringing equipment up from the lower 48.
Yeah, so
yes,
I
sir.
Just kept it in the car and in the van, and I drove up with it. Representative Story.
Yes. Do you have any idea of the breakdown of how many use it for military and the use on freight and cargo?
The Port of Bellingham does not. We don't necessarily have access to that information. I believe the Alaska Marine Highway System does have that information, and we can get it from them.
And as far as funding from the state of Alaska, you receive funding in the form of lease payments. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so every year rises within some.
I think it's locked in until the lease term ends. I believe that's 3-4 years from now, and then it'd be renegotiated. There's two sources of revenue. One is the lease payments for the facility, and then two is what I call reimbursable expenses. There's ticketing agents, et cetera, that we pay on the state's behalf, the state of Alaska's behalf, and then you reimburse us for those expenses.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from the committee?
I really appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fix, and sorry for keeping you waiting so long, and I'm glad we got you in right at the bell at 3:00. I thank the committee members for being here today, and our next meeting in this room 124, which is this one, 1:30 on Thursday, March 21st, hearing HB 34 and HB 88, and I will adjourn this meeting at 3 p.m. Thank you.